tonight on Arena. Paul Whittington on the winners and losers at last night's Oscars, and Fiona Scarlett on her debut novel, Boys Don't Cry. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In a show co-produced by Steven Soderbergh, the 93rd Academy Awards took place in LA last night amid socially distanced Hollywood royalty, including at one point Glenn Close gamely twerking for the cameras. Chloe Zhao's film Nomadland, starring Frances McDormand, won the three biggest awards: Best Picture, Best Director and Best Actress. Elsewhere, trophies were evenly spread out across a range of films, with the best animation feature going to the frontrunner Pixar, and sadly our own Cartoon Saloon therefore didn't win for their Wolf Walkers, but I'm sure their day will come. Paul Whittington stayed up all night watching the ceremony and he joins me now. Was it worth the lack of sleep, Paul?
Some of the night, Sean. I mean, I think, to be honest, they were damned if they did and damned if they didn't with this ceremony, because had it been anything close to the usual kind of, you know, backpatting and self-congratulation, that would have played very badly in a country where, you know, hundreds of thousands have died in the last year. It was a very muted affair, it's true, but obviously because of COVID restrictions, numbers were small, and it was done in Union Station rather than in the Kodak Theatre. I mean, I thought it was okay. It was a little bit muted, but that was to be expected. It was a little bit short on personality, maybe. But then that's because for the third year in a row, they didn't have a one presenter. They had, you know, stars shuffling on and off.
What a disaster. No presenter. What were they thinking of? Surely they know that such a thing is essential to the success of any show.
Any endeavour, absolutely, Sean.
Absolutely. And there's no bias in that statement for me, it has to be said. Union Station, Los Angeles, how did it look? It kind of sounds on one hand like an unusual venue, but I'm sure the practicalities of COVID, etc., were part of the reason for choosing this venue.
Yeah, I think it suited very well, and there were big outer areas, and they made the decision to take all the music out of it, partly for COVID reasons. And so that was all done in a kind of pre-show. And the guests sat around in little booths, like they were watching sort of dinner theatre or something, and sort of waved demurely to each other during the show. And that part of it worked quite well. Some critics have given out about the fact that the nominees and films nominated were too worthy, but I think that's kind of a nonsense, because I can't think of, you know, any big films that were kind of that were overlooked. You should remember that in the last year, a lot of, you know, big films were not released, and these for me are more or less the best of those that were.
Right. And of course, if there weren't any worthy films that they'd be giving out, that there were no films other than just bland entertainment. However, such is life. Let's have a listen to the big winner of the evening.
And the Oscar goes to Nomadland.
On behalf of my fellow producers, Peter Spear, Molly Asher, Dan Genvey, and the one and only Frances McDormand, we thank the Academy, and we thank our brilliant fellow nominees, and we thank all the hearts and hands that come together to make this movie. From Searchlight Pictures, Jessica Buder, who trusted us with her beautiful book, to our brilliant cinematographer, Joshua James Richards, and to the entire Nomadland company. We want to show our deepest gratitude to Linda May, Swanky, Bob Wells, and Nomadic community, all the people we met on the road. Thank you for teaching us the power of resilience and hope, and for reminding us what true kindness looks like. And now I give you Fern.
No, I'm not. I'm Fran. Please watch our movie on the largest screen possible, and one day, very, very soon, take everyone you know into a theater, shoulder to shoulder, in that dark space, and watch every film that's represented here tonight. We give this one to our wolf. Oh!
Good old Fran, Frances McDormand there. Part of the acceptance for the best picture team with Chloe Zhao because she produced it along with Chloe Zhao. Then Chloe Zhao winning Best Director, first female to win since Kathryn Bigelow back in 2010 for Hurt Locker, and the first female of colour to win Best Director in all time. And again, we had the Best Actress award for Fran, not Fern, which is the character she plays in Nomadland. A deserved winner of those three awards, would you say, Paul?
Absolutely, widely predicted, Sean. But I mean, I think you'll probably be reviewing this film this week, won't you?
Yeah.
But it's a tremendous film. I saw it before Christmas, and it's just very unusual, and it's quite in its roundabout way, it's quite profound in terms of what it says about America, and not just America, but how we live generally and about capitalism. And it's a beautiful film to look at. And I think Frances McDormand, I love the fact that she mentioned cinema, because this is hopefully the first and last year where a lot of these films haven't seen a cinema and nobody's seen them in cinema. So hopefully that will pass. But an absolutely worthy winner. And although in the Best Actress category, you know, Carey Mulligan definitely would have had a shout and would have been a worthy winner, I think you couldn't go by McDormand's performance in this.
And as well as the review, we will be hearing from Chloe Zhao tomorrow evening on the programme as well, so looking forward to that enormously. The big surprise came in the Chadwick Boseman non-winner of the Best Actor category. Everybody was expecting him to win for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I don't mean to be cruel, but if you could be totally objective on this one, Paul, his death was obviously a terrible tragedy, but if he hadn't died, would he have been a dead cert, as people thought he was, for this award?
No, I don't think he would. I think, personally, if he hadn't died, he would have been nominated in the Best Supporting Actor category, which is where he should have been. And Daniel Kaluuya should have been nominated in the Best Actor category, which he then might have won. And Chadwick, had he been alive, might have won Best Supporting Actor. But it all got mixed up in, obviously, sentiment and his tragic death at the age of 42. And and the fact also that they changed the running order, and instead of having Best Picture last, they had Best Actor. So everybody thought it's going to be a big tribute to Chadwick, and instead, of course, it was Anthony Hopkins, who wasn't even there; he was in his bed.
And who accepted the award on his behalf?
Nobody did. Joaquin Phoenix said the Academy accepts this award on your behalf, and everybody went home.
Bit of a damp squib at the end of it. I'm delighted, though, for Daniel Kaluuya for Judas and the Black Messiah. I mean, that's a well-deserved. And I mean, technically, I suppose it is there are two kind of lead characters. Therefore, it's not a lead role, it's a supporting role. Technicality, I suppose, there.
Yeah.
Funniest moment of the evening, I think, probably went to Yoon Yo-jung, major actor in Korea. She won Best Supporting Actress for her role in the moving family drama Ranari, which I think we spoke about with you on the programme, Paul.
Yes.
Tell us what she did last night. Really classy move.
Well, she has form, because she was very funny at the BAFTAs as well, but she came up onto the stage and she's quite overwhelmed, even though she's a huge actress in her own country. And Brad Pitt presented her, and she went up on stage and said, "Mr. Brad Pitt, finally, nice to meet you." And she was flirting with him, and it was fantastic, and he really got into the spirit of it as well. She was a very worthy winner. Poor old Glenn Close, who is very good at losing because she does it so often. This is her eighth time that she's been overlooked, but in truth, she shouldn't have really have been nominated for Hillbilly Elegy, because that was a pretty fruity performance in a bad film, I think. But if she's nominated again, Sean, they can't do it to her again.
I suppose, but if somebody else is better, they can.
No, it just wouldn't be
wouldn't
humane.
Be fair, do you think? Wouldn't be humane.
I think I don't know if you heard Daniel Kaluuya's speech was very funny as well, because he went off on one in a kind of very charming way and said something about my mum met my dad, they had sex, it's wonderful, and his mother was in the audience with her head in her hands.
Yeah, and his sister was there as well, kind of doing stop now, Daniel, please. you mentioned there about Glenn Close. We all think it's very nasty if they don't eventually give Cartoon Saloon some kind of award. I mean, is it, how many nominations are we talking about now at this stage in total across categories? Is it four or five?
Four, I think. Sean, and I think you spoke to them. I spoke to them as well. The makers, Tom, and
beautiful film.
Like, it's a lovely film, but I just think in another year, when Pixar did a kind of slightly more ordinary film, they would have stood a chance. But Soul was just too good, too beautiful, too clever, to overlook. So I think they would have known down there that
right.
that they weren't going to. And nominations mean a huge deal to Cartoon Saloon, to an operation like
well,
them.
They
do terrifically well.
Yeah, I wouldn't underestimate the success that it is to have the nomination. And certainly from all of us, big congratulations on that. As I said, I have no doubt that the day will come when we'll be celebrating an Oscar win from Cartoon Saloon. Paul, great to speak with you this evening. It sounds like you had a good evening. Are you going off to bed now in about 10 minutes?
No, I'm grand, Sean. I'll stay up a bit, yeah.
Till 8 o'clock.
Thanks, Sean.
All right, thanks. Paul Whittington there. The Moth Poetry Prize was originally set up 10 years ago. Oh, by the way, the Oscars are on tonight on television, on RTE2 television. Yes, they are. The Moth Poetry Prize was originally set up 10 years ago in 2011 to help boost the careers of poets from around the world who submit previously unpublished works to the Moth magazine. This year, Moth magazine received over 4,000 entries, the winner of which will be announced this Thursday, April the 29th. This year's judge, dividing an overall prize of fund of €11,000, is Rooney Prize winner and current chair of creative writing at the Seamus Heaney Centre, Nick Laird. Throughout this week here in Arena, we will be bringing you the four finalists for 2021, and hopefully we'll speak to the winner on our show this coming Thursday. This year, of the four finalists, two are from the UK and two are from the United States. Here's the first of those four finalists, New York poet Suzanne Cleary, and this is a poem called "For the Poet Who Writes to Me While Standing in a Line at CVS Waiting for His Mother's Prescription."
For Russell Jackson. It's nothing that you flat out say, Russell, but your email reminds me that 6 months into pandemic, 5 months into quarantine, CVS remains open 24 hours, its harsh blue-white light steady, as nothing in nature is steady. Those long fluorescent bulbs still dive-bombing lumens so that midnight is bright as 8 a.m. or 4 a.m. or 2 p.m. or 7:30 p.m. You can see that I struggle to carry one thought to the next these long days. I spend hours on the internet, becoming expert on the height of actors from Hollywood's golden age, on the 25 cutest photos of 4-year-old Princess Charlotte.
And there we go. That's the first of our offerings from this year's Moth Poetry Prize. Suzanne Cleary with the poem with the long title, "For the Poet Who Writes to Me While Standing in Line at CVS Waiting for His Mother's Prescription." And we will be playing more of those from the four finalists throughout the week, and hopefully speaking to the winner on Thursday night. Fiona Scarlett's debut novel, Boys Don't Cry, is the story of two brothers, Finn and Joe, growing up in a tower block in Dublin, one of them facing tragedy, the other facing a choice. The book was inspired by a tweet from a palliative care doctor and Fiona's late father, and his inspirational attitude to helping children from disadvantaged backgrounds, as well as working full-time as a primary school teacher. Fiona studied creative writing at the University of Glasgow, and delighted to say that she joins me now. First of all, my sympathies on the death of your father, Paddy, who I knew from a while back now when I was involved with a series of concerts around youth orchestras in the concert hall, and your father, Paddy, was very much part of that. When did he die, Fiona, and how do you think he feeds into this book?
Yeah, thanks so much, Sean, and for having me. I'm delighted to be here. He died just in December, Sean, so it's fairly recent.
Yeah.
And as you said, he sort of set up the Festival of Music there for County Dublin VEC schools, and very much wanted to have a sort of stage and an audience for children from disadvantaged areas to allow them the space to enjoy music, really, and to have the space for people to come and listen and that. So the main, like, one of the inspirations, as you were saying, is Dad himself. So he grew up just off Dorset Street, well, where he called home. He sort of moved around quite a bit, but that's where he associated with home most of all. And I think the reason is because when he was about 10 or 11, his own father signed himself and his brother up. There was a man in Parnell Square who was doing free music lessons for children in the area. And my granddad signed the two of them up, and he saw a bit of potential in my dad and his brother, and eventually ended up getting them scholarships to the College of Music. And sure, as you know yourself, then music was Dad's life, really.
Yeah.
And he went then to college himself in his 30s. There was three kids at the time at home, to train as a music secondary school teacher. So to be able to give that opportunity to the young adults in his care, really, that he was giving himself. So there's a lot of him in the book, all right.
And it's two brothers, really, that you're telling us about here. There's no biographical relevance in that respect. It's not your father's story. It's not anybody you know's story. But I guess it's the type of stories that your father might have been familiar with in some of the places where he was working and some of the children that he was working with.
Yeah, most definitely. And sort of the story or the book itself sort of explores a lot about choice and the choices you make really in the aftermath of a tragedy, but also how circumstances like your family background or where you're from, family circumstances, how they can actually impact the choices that are made available to you. I remember working before in a school where I had a young student and he used to get two buses to go to school because school was a nicer place to be. So there was nobody in his household getting him up to go to school, but that was his choice. Either he stays at home and or else he gets two buses to come to a place that's just a safer environment for him. So my father as well would have had a lot of children like that he taught throughout the years as well, you know. And he was very much a believer of one person being able to make a difference in somebody else's life. So when he passed away, the amount of messages we got from past pupils was just phenomenal. About stories of him, you know.
And Joe and Finn then, your fictional characters, 17-year-old Joe and 12-year-old Finn. It kind of struck me, I know you have two children yourself, a boy and a girl, but and now they're not, I suppose the younger child, I think your younger child is in the early teens and your older child's in kind of mid-teens, if I've got the years right.
Yeah. They're 13 and 10.
Yeah, so,
so slightly younger.
Yeah, a little bit younger than the two boys, and a boy and a girl, opposed to two boys. When did you discover that, in fact, it was a story about two brothers and brotherly love and brotherly loyalty and all of those things are really at the heart of Joe and Finn's story?
Yeah, it's so strange because, as you mentioned there earlier as well, the spark of inspiration came. There was a tweet about 3 years ago now on Twitter. It was from a paediatric palliative care doctor. And in the tweet, he was talking about where the nurses and himself asked children in his care what they would miss the most when they died. So, of course, it was an incredibly powerful and moving tweet. Yeah. And the first thing I did after reading that was I opened up the laptop and I wrote the first chapter of the book. And the first chapter is virtually unchanged. It's more or less identical now in print as it was those 3 years ago. And then the story more or less came fully formed. And originally I thought it was going to be a story about the ma Annie and Finn. Mm. But when I sat down to actually write it, it was Joe and Finn. So it was really strange the way it came about. It was just, the story was just sorted there as soon as I started writing.
That's interesting because it really struck me, that opening section, because throughout the rest of the book, we get various parts of the story told from either Joe's point of view or Finn's point of view. But that opening section starts with ice cream, any flavour, chocolate, banana, strawberry, or the one that is all three striped together, sandwiched away for a screwball from Mr. Whippy. And so it was on, and that what to me felt like I had to read it at breakneck pace in a kind of a it's almost like a series of impressions of a childhood running around playing, looking for ice cream, doing this, getting into trouble, dodging trouble, having fun, playing and running around the place.
Yeah, it's like nearly a stream of consciousness or that, you know. So he's processing that sort of, even though that's at the beginning of the book, it's sort of like a prologue, I suppose. It's set quite near the end. You see near the end when he's talking about making up, you know, the things that he'll miss the most. So this is what it is. He's sort of trying to think in his head, what are the things he's actually going to miss the most, you know?
Yeah, and one of the aspects is in this book, which I think must be incredibly difficult to write, and maybe the reason why you have two boys as opposed to a boy and a girl like your own children, we are dealing with illness and childhood illness, which is incredibly difficult to read, very moving to read, and I can imagine difficult enough to write too.
Yeah, do you know, it's a funny one because I actually found the character of Joe much, much harder to write because I think because with Finn, we sort of know what's going to happen to him.
Yeah, Finn is ill. And Finn is the kid who's ill.
Yeah, that's right. And I was able to remove myself a little bit from that. But what was really important to me is that it was an honest portrayal of families and children who deal with circumstances like this. So I read a lot of blogs, like from the perspective of parents and from the perspective of siblings as well, going through something similar, because that was one thing that was really, really important to me, that the feeling was right and that it was honest and it wasn't condescending or patronising or bogged down with medical jargon or any of those type of things, you know.
And Joe, then, you say, was the more difficult story to write, or the more difficult voice, perhaps, to get into. His story is more complicated in that he's a very bright guy.
Yeah.
He maybe doesn't have all the chances that people from other socioeconomic backgrounds would have. He also has a family link to criminality that he just has to fight against and try not to be sucked into, and finds himself being sucked into. So it's a constant battle for him.
It's a constant battle. And I found that when I was writing him as well, it was like Joe has this armour up all the time. And I found as a writer, I was nearly excusing his actions. And I remember just, it was well into the editing process where I was watching the author of Call Me By Your Name. He was doing a webinar, Andre, I can't remember his surname now, but he was doing a webinar talking about Call Me By the Name. And one of the questions came in and said, why don't the characters say I love you in the story? And he said, but those characters, they'd never actually say it. So it was like a light bulb moment when he said that I went back to the character Joe and I took out loads of chunks where it was me. It was me talking through the story rather than Joe in the story. So I just was really, really conscious of trying to take myself out of it as much as possible. So just to let him, that I didn't need to explain away his actions, and to allow that space for the reader as well. You know, leaving space for the reader would be really important to me as well. So I was really conscious of just trying to remove myself out of it as much as possible.
And telling that socioeconomic story, was that something that was in your mind from very earlier on? Or you were saying that finding Joe's story actually was much more difficult than finding Finn's. Did that kind of catch you unawares in some ways too?
Yeah, I think so. Because like the question that everybody asks is that Finn's storyline must have been really, really difficult to write because of what happens to him, because of the childhood illness and everything that surrounds his storyline. But it was just trying to stay true to the character of Joe as well. And again, getting back to that honesty and not wanting to patronise. And I wanted to be a subtlety in there as well. And that I'm just, this story is like a snapshot in time for this particular family dealing with certain circumstances, you know, and again, allowing that space for the reader in there and not to be making any sort of points or judgments, or just trying to approach everything with empathy as much as possible and kindness and compassion, I suppose, as well, you know.
And again, I wonder, Fiona, to what extent did your own teaching background, you know, help in the writing of this novel as well? In that, perhaps, you know, there's this idea that whose story is this to tell? Are you coming from a very different perspective into this different socioeconomic background? And to do that, I know empathy is one of the things that you certainly would need. I guess to get the authenticity was vitally important to you too.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm from Mulholder Town in Dublin 15. And in the late 90s and 2000 in Dublin 15, the criminal gang, the Westies, were operating out of there at the time. And it's really strange because when there is that sort of drug culture, it's completely normalised in your community. You don't really see it as being an issue or a concern, especially when you're removed from it in some way. And again, when I look back, it's, you'd know who the heroin addicts were on the back of the bus, or there was a drug rehabilitation centre next to the community school that I went to. So it was just ingrained in there. And also, of course, my father, he was working in Carduff at the time. So there was a lot of that there in the area at the time. And that's another thing that I'm really conscious of as well, is that when you're looking at areas of disadvantage, that not every single person living in an area of disadvantage is necessarily disadvantaged as well. And again, trying to approach that with subtlety and looking at the family support system. So like, for instance, the character of Jasmine in the book, like there's a section in there when she's talking about, I want to be a specialist, and someone, like one of the friends, is slagging her off. Sure, how would you be a specialist? And she said, well, my dad says I can be anything I want to be. So she has this family support network there who is telling her she can be anything she wants to be, and she will be anything she wants to be. And she's living in the same exact same terror block as the boys. So it's trying to get away from that sort of, I suppose, postcode discrimination, as well as everything else. You
and
know?
Of course, one of the things you're definitely exploring when we look at the title is Boys Don't Cry. Boys are young males are particularly expected to behave in a certain way, and not crying may well be part of that. Finally, did your dad, I'm hoping he did, get to see the finished book?
No, he actually didn't, Sean. He saw the cover. Yeah, he saw the cover, all right. And I was actually in the middle of the final proof of the book when he first went into hospital. So, yeah, he never actually got to read it, but he did know it was coming out, and he got to see the cover at least. Anyway,
well, that's a good bit. And yeah. the dedication does read for my dad, who continues to inspire me every day. Good to have him with you as opposed to anything else. Lovely to speak with you, Fiona, and congratulations on the debut.
That's lovely. Thanks so much, Sean. It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
That's Fiona Scarlett, and her debut is called Boys Don't Cry. It's published by Faber and Faber. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams are two giants of 20th century American literature. The two men, who were dear friends, were both gay. They were both from the deep south of the United States, and they both achieved popular and critical success early in their careers. In addition to all of this, they both battled alcoholism and depression, and they died within a year of each other in the early 1980s. A new documentary feature film, Truman and Tennessee, An Intimate Conversation, pairs the voices of each of these two legendary writers and develops as a parallel exploration of their experience of writing, of success and failure, and of friendship. The film was made by Lisa Imordina Vreeland, and I'm delighted to be joined by Lisa this evening on the programme. It's an incredible way to get these two men beside each other talking about the same topics, talking about writing together. You describe it, Lisa, as an encounter between the two writers in their own words. Where did this idea, this format of literally splicing one man talking, then the other man talking, usually about a very similar topic, where did the idea come from?
Well, you know what? Thank you. First of all, thank you for including me on the show tonight and inviting me. No, you know what? I have to say that it was a fortunate mistake in the sense that I had wanted to make a film on Truman Capote, and another film came out, and it just my producer mentioned to me, he said, you know, you should include Tennessee Williams in it. And then all of a sudden what it did was opened up a door to this kind of a whole world that we could create and really create a tête-à-tête, that we could give the audience this feeling that they were eavesdropping in on a conversation. And as a team of, I'm talking about the team of us who created the film, what was so nice about it was that it gave us a sense of great freedom because, you know, not at any time were we creating a biopic. So it gave us this freedom to be able to go from one subject and one topic to the next. And so we were fortunate. I mean, it was a real pleasure to make this film.
Yeah, life throws up some great accidents to us, and those accidents often give us great results. Now, we have two ways of hearing the two writers' voices. We have lots of archival material, or you give us lots of archival material, television interviews where we see the men, and it is their voices that we hear as well. But you also have actors Jim Parsons and Zachary Quinto giving us the voices of Truman and Tennessee, respectively. And I want to play, to start out, a clip from the beginning of the film that gives us a sense of how you overlap the voices of the two men.
I was 16 years old when I met Tennessee. He was 13 years older than I was. We became great friends. It really was a sort of intellectual friendship, though people inevitably thought otherwise.
Truman was magical and sweet and ferociously curious when I first knew him. Life was a wonderful basket of gifts he loved digging through, and he took and he shared. He was adorable.
Tennessee had a remarkable laugh. It wasn't coarse or vulgar, or even especially loud. It just had an amazing sort of throaty Mississippi riverman ring to it. You could always tell when he walked into a room, no matter how many people were there.
The voices there of Jim Parsons and Zachary Quinto in the documentary feature film Truman and Tennessee, An Intimate Conversation. The director of the film, Lisa Imordina Vreeland, is with me this evening. And as I said, Lisa, it's always, while we have two actors there, Jim Parsons and Zachary Quinto, voicing the two writers, it's always the writer's own words. What they're saying are from diaries or from letters or from articles that the two men had written.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. It really is. And that's what was so nice in the process of making the film, because when I was researching it, I would, you know, I read lots of books, so all the published biographies, but then, of course, I went into each writer's archives, which are accessible to really anybody. And that helped create the script in a way. But, you know, what we also used as a launching pad for it was, you know, these very strong interview of David Frost that really is the launching pad for the whole thing, because he was so introspective with both of them. He prodded them and prodded them to a point that he was physically prodding them with his hand in the interview itself, and getting out these kind of inner secrets that are, it's quite strange to see it, because talk show hosts are just not like that today. And they were so revealing.
Yeah, it is extraordinary when you watch David Frost, particularly in the Truman Capote interview, I thought, he sits opposite him and they are locked. Their eyes are locked on each other. They barely take their eyes off each other. And he just sits calmly, asks the question, waits and waits and waits. And these were very clever men that he was interviewing. They weren't going to be trapped easily. Let's have a listen, in fact, to a section from the film where you have the two David Frost interviews, one with Truman Capote himself, one with Tennessee Williams, and they're intercut in the film. But I think in the audio, you'll be able to hear the change from one interview to the other.
Will you welcome the man who's that magnificent writer? And will you welcome a great dramatist?
It's Mr. Truman Capote.
Mr. Tennessee Williams. You're a star. At what age did you realize that you were a star writer personality, a star?
I've got to separate these two things, a personality or a writer.
Well, you're a mixture of the two. What was the spur that initially started you writing, do you think?
Well, my mother bought me a typewriter when I was 13. And I think I'd already shown some interest in writing. Probably around 11.
People say they can see you in your plays and they can see your
family.
Well,
I'm very personal as a writer, yes. I don't mean to be, I just am. Unavoidably.
The voice of Tennessee Williams there, the voice of David Frost in two interviews, one with Tennessee Williams, the other with Truman Capote, and that features in the film we're talking about this evening, Truman and Tennessee, an intimate conversation. When you see and hear the two interviews up beside each other, Lisa, you kind of think, how could you not look at these two men together as opposed to separately? It's almost as if the questions mirror each other in many ways, and that's a compliment to David Frost.
Well, you know, it is. And in a funny way, I mean, I already had the Truman Capote interview. And then when the Tennessee Williams came up, I was just like, oh, my gosh, these are, because there was such great depth to them. And then visually, they also were so beautiful, because I loved the set of his interview set. And I have to say that this intention, because I really wanted to use the words of Truman and Tennessee to create a rhythm in the film. And David Frost just kind of joined on to all of that quite naturally. It was very, very interesting that happened like that. And, you know, because the film really ultimately is about, you know, these two great writers and how they needed to express themselves, and it was really essential to their being. And their stories had so many interesting parallels and very sad ones also, you know, many, many sad ones.
Terrible sadnesses. But in that very last comment of Tennessee Williams, I think a great parallel as well in the, I suppose it's more obvious in the Tennessee Williams plays, the autobiographical aspect of his work. Mm-hmm. He seems to be all over it. Capote's is a little bit more, I suppose, covered up or masked in some ways. But they are both, their writings are incredibly autobiographical.
I agree. And I think that, you know, you can really get a sense, because I knew quite a lot already about Truman Capote, because he's been circling in my work for a while, because he's friendly with a lot of the characters of my past films. And, you know, he was friends with Mrs. Vreeland, with Peggy Guggenheim, and very good friends with Cecil Beaton. So he has been kind of there in my orbit for some time. But Tennessee, I really got to know through this film. And there's an honesty to the way he approached everything he did, and really an authenticity I felt to him. And in his own journals, he talks about his depression. He talks about his addiction. He talks about also his sexual addiction, because he was also really was a sex addict as well. But there's a clarity in the way that he thought. With Truman, there was something, there was a veneer of truth that was not always, you know, it was this whole kind of thought of reinvention, which is something I've toyed with a lot of the characters that I've done films on. But he, you know, he was an invented character from quite a young age. And Tennessee Williams just did not have that in his character. It was not of importance. For him, the importance was to write, to express himself, and to try to rid himself of some of those demons, which ultimately, unfortunately, he didn't. I'm sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, but, not at all. Go ahead. He couldn't rid himself of the demons. That was the great sadness of it.
Yes, yes. No, I agree. You know, I do fundamentally feel that when there are people who have come from a childhood that has been broken, it's very, very hard to kind of catch up with yourself during one's lifetime. I think that it leaves there's something that just surrounds your life and about yourself as a persona. And this is, you know, this is a very clear example of that in both cases, because, you know, Truman as a child, the fact that he was locked in these rooms by his mother, and Tennessee never had the support from both of his parents. I mean, thankfully he had his grandparents from his mother's side, but he never had the support or attention. And this whole sense of the lack of love has a huge, huge effect on anyone's life.
There's a great,
and I think you really do see it.
Yeah, there's a great caption that you put up at the very beginning of the film, how the two men goaded and supported each other into the in the ongoing quest to turn life into art. And they did goad each other. And they were both quite witty in the way they knew how to tease the other person. But to what extent do you think that teasing was pure affection? Or was there a little bit of jealousy involved as well?
You know, I think, of course, there's some jealousy. I do think that Truman was much more the jealous person. You know, let's not forget that Tennessee Williams won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. So that already, you know, that's kind of a little check mark next to his name that was quite different. Truman Capote only won a literary prize when he was younger. And so that already was an achievement that for him was so far away. And, I think they did like to, you know, bother each other, and, you know, the sense of competition, you know, that the world and, you know, that inner circle was quite small, because first the world was smaller back then, but, you know, their world was, you know, they all knew the same people, and even the world that they knew in Europe, because they both were expats, they spent so much time over there. You know, if they went to Morocco, both of them obviously were going to see Paul and Jane Bowles. So, you know, their social world was also quite similar. And, you know, they were, of course, we know that Tennessee Williams was very close to Gore Vidal. And we also know that Truman Capote got into a huge fight with Gore Vidal. So it's much smaller than you think. Yeah. But, you know, ultimately, I think that Tennessee Williams was, you know, was the grander person, because he did write this letter to Truman in 1978. And we add a little bit of it toward the end of the film, saying that, you know, he really he got over what Truman had written about him in his story. But what he said was that, you know, he wanted to be sure that Truman was taking care of himself. So he was the bigger persona in the end, and the grander persona. Yeah.
And certainly love wins through, and the friendship between them wins through at the end. And I never want to see a documentary about a single writer again. I always want to see them in doubles now. and that's thanks to you, Lisa. Lisa Immerdeen of Vreeland, thanks very much for speaking to us this evening, Lisa.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Lisa's film is called Truman in Tennessee, An Intimate Conversation. It will be available to stream from this Friday. 13 minutes to 8 on Monday night's Arena. Voices of Anuna there with the opening of the traditional song Jerusalem. New film by the founder of Anuna, Michael McGlynn, is one of the centrepieces of this year's reimagined Cork International Choral Festival. Like so many events last year, Cork International Choral Festival had to cancel its event due to COVID-19. This year, the festival is back, albeit in a virtual reimagining. Four specially curated gala concerts will be staged online during the festival, which begins on Wednesday. On Thursday night, Anuna, Ireland's famed choral group, will present their concert in film form. To tell me more, I'm joined by founder of Anuna and composer Michael McGlynn and choir member Sorka Fenlon. Michael, as we see at the beginning of the film, your relationship with Cork International Choral Festival goes back a long way, and in fact was hugely formative, I think it's safe to say, in your own work and in the founding of Anuna.
Hello, Sean. Just it was very nice and disarming to hear Ian McGlynn's voice just coming in from the ad break. Ian, of course, is my cousin. Hello, Ian. Yes, it's a very interesting thing to be asked back this year, particularly. We began our time in Cork in 1990 when we actually competed as Anuenya. But before that, I really was represented by UCD Chamber Choir, which I conducted, and then after that, Trinity College Singers. But what was interesting was that it gave me a platform to write choral music for the first time, which was adjudicated by no less luminaries than people like John Tavener. So it was very interesting. It was a very interesting way for a young composer to start, particularly in such a minority musical form. And I suppose in many ways, Cork was very formative in the early years of my development rather than Anuna's.
And in terms of choral composition, was that always there for you, Michael? Was that kind of the dream from a very early stage?
No, I have absolutely minimal interest in choral music, to be honest with you. And Anuna isn't technically a choir. It's like comparing hip hop with death metal, for example. No, I'm being absolutely serious.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is that with Anuna in particular, it is always judged as a choir simply because people in this country don't really have a vocabulary that extends beyond that comparison. And it most definitely is not a choir. It's more like a band. So I think from my point of view as a composer, I would say I'm a writer. I write music in many genres. I've written as diverse as I've written lyrics for video games, and I've also wrote a song with the country music legend Rodney Crowell, which was actually sung by Sheryl Crow 2 years ago on record. So I would call myself a writer rather than a composer.
Yeah. Well, I guess it does speak to the way in which Anuna performs, and maybe if we take Sorka in at this point, and what it was attracted to her, because it attracted her to the ensemble initially. In your case, in fact, what Michael is speaking about there, it speaks directly to why you like being part of Anuna. You didn't necessarily want to be part of a choir, I think, is actually the starting point for you, Sorka.
Yeah, that would be exactly it. Hello, Sean. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Sorka.
That's exactly it. As Michael said, you know, it was the fact that Anuna wasn't a choir that attracted me to it. I had sang in choirs before, in school, in college. But I knew there was something very special and very different about Anuna. I wasn't sure yet what it was when I kind of first approached it. But I mean, for a start, we've no conductor at any time kind of during performance, which is obviously a huge difference to a standard choir. But I suppose for me, it's the use of the space as well. That makes it really kind of stand out. In performance, you know, we kind of get in among the audience a lot of the time, and that it's almost woven into the pieces that way. That we kind of have to connect with each other, with our breath. So it's just, yeah, it is. It's very far removed from, I suppose, a standard choir, as Michael said.
Well,
yeah.
Circa is somewhat hiding her light under a bushel there, because actually she has sung solo off-Broadway. She's a specialist in musical drama. The fact of the matter is that the singers in Anune, each one of them is, well, most of them are specialists, but most of them, I think at this point, the vast majority of the singers are not located in Ireland. So when they arrive, they bring skills from bands, from we have a very, very specific early music specialist, Jan Kuhar, in Switzerland. And then we have a number of Icelandic and American and Dutch and Spanish and Italian singers. So it's very much, it's Slovenian as well. It's very much a case of coming together and creating something magical. And that's what we've tried to do with this film. You're getting sort of an insight into one of the elements of Anune that would not be well known, which is, of course, that it's based on the concept of composition and creation. It grows like a tree. It's organic. And it's just lovely to be able to reach back. I mean, the first date there in that documentary is 1985. I cannot believe I've been doing it that long.
Let me go to a piece that's, again, close to the beginning of the film, from 1993.
Oh, yes.
The Raid is... Now, you talk about Anune's probably more like a band than it is like anything, than it is like a choir. Well, you had a front man for The Raid, for sure. A front man who became a very well-known household name in the meantime. A young fella called Hosier. Little clip of Hosier Byrne, as he would have been called then, Andrew Hosier Byrne, performing in The Raid in an Anune performance from 1993, actually. Did I say in 83?
1993. Yes.
And that's part of the film that Michael McGlynn and Circa Fenlon are speaking to us about this evening, that will be part of this year's reimagined Cork International Choral Festival. Circa mentioned there, Michael, this idea of no conductor. So you're often singing in the choir, I shouldn't say a choir, you're often singing in the group.
Well, now, come on, Sean, I've never seen anyone conduct a rock band.
No, exactly that.
And if I can ask you, Sean, what is it distinguishes a choir from a rock band?
Oh, I guess the conductor, is it? Well, possibly the type of music as
well. Well, hold on a sec. Prior to the early part of the 19th century, conductors were one of many. They were not actually standing out in front of the group invariably. And if we remember the famous story of Lully, who put a post through his foot and died of blood poisoning, because the way he used to conduct was he used to bang a stick on the ground. At the time of Palestrina, there was one of the singers wave their hand, but very rarely did they need a conductor. That's a construct of the last 200 years. And unfortunately, I find conductors most of the time get in the way. And they get in the way of people taking responsibility for themselves. And Anune is all about singing together on your own. And that's the way all choral music should be, which I suppose explains why we're just a little bit out of step with everybody else here.
And explain then, Circa, that this idea of the breath, and how this breath that you literally catch, almost like the rock band, the guitarist lifting up the hands to get ready to play. There's something like that. Explain the breath, how it works, Circa.
So in the kind of way we would stand, you know, it's usually kind of given to someone to kind of lead that breath, but it's a kind of and just a really simple. It sounds more complex, really, I suppose, but it really is as simple as just catching that millisecond and then breathing together. Like, even if your, say, voice part, you know, the altos or whatever, aren't coming in to sing that phrase, we would still take that breath all together because we start the piece together then that way. And it just, it's a kind of just an intake of breath and a release, you know, it's, it can't get stuck, if you like. So that's, and that's why I suppose we all make that effort to take it together. And we often actually involve the audience in it as well, to kind of just show them exactly how we're doing it and exactly how we're singing. And it makes it a very special, I suppose, connection then as well.
It's very much a unified thing, isn't it, Circa? I mean, we have these extraordinary experiences where we get the audience to breathe with us, mainly to stop them coughing, which can be very irritating because it disrupts the breath. We work under three basic ideas: the idea of the breath, the idea of intent, what are we here to do, and the word, what are you speaking to people about? And I think that that's actually what distinguishes us from so many others.
And that idea of the breath, Michael, was that something that just grew organically over the years, or was it an idea you had from the very outset?
No, you see, Anuna has been, it sits uniquely in Ireland. And I suppose it's because we had that extraordinary boost at the beginning of the 1990s from Riverdance that we were suddenly catapulted out on our own, so far away from the rest of choral music in this country that we no longer have any relationship to it in any way, with any connection. So it's wonderful to be here, and we're with Limerick Sings later on as well too. But what's interesting is that the we've just developed uniquely. And when I travel across the world, well, when I will again, I meet other people like us elsewhere. And we have connected with other groups all over the world, almost a mini revolution in the way that people communally work together. Choirs are not about people singing together. They are about communities being created, and being created sometimes through artwork, which is 600-700 years old, speaking with the voice and the words of somebody who's long dead and bringing them into your presence. It's a miraculous way of singing. It is a pity that it is not treated with the respect it deserves in this country, because it is not. Infrastructurally, it is supported extremely badly, I mean, compared to most other places I'm in. But maybe that'll change in time. I hope so.
I suppose people might watch the film and get a sense of what you're talking about there.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Thanks for being with us this evening. That's Michael McGlynn and Circa Fenlon from Anuna. And the Cork International Choral Festival runs from Wednesday, April the 28th through until May the 2nd. CorkChoral.ie for full details there. And that is our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was in sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Olin McGowan. I'll be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock as usual here on RTE Radio 1.